According to cancer.gov, about 70,000 young people between the ages of 15 and 39 are diagnosed with cancer every year. And we're talking about cancer in young adults on the show today. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for staying with us here on the Ideas Network. Our next guest is Dr. Ryan Madison. He is an associate professor of medicine within the Division of Hematology Oncology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He practices at the UW Carbone Cancer Center, and he specializes there in blood cancers, including leukemia. And we heard a bit about leukemia from our guest, Suleika Jawad. It's great to have him with us today. We'll talk about the challenges of treating young adults, answer your questions. We'll specifically talk about young adults with cancer, but we could take other cancer-related questions as well. You can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Dr. Ryan Madison, with us by phone. Dr. Madison, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry, for having me, and I appreciated hearing the last bit of the interview with Suleika, so it's great to have her on the show, and looking forward to having her on campus in October.
Yeah, she is an amazing young woman, I tell you. And she had leukemia. It was an acute, what do they call them, a myeloid?
I believe she had acute myeloid leukemia, right, that was treated with a bone marrow transplant as part of her therapy, so... I've never met her. I don't know her personally, but I've had a chance to read some of her work. So quite a story she has to tell and really bring awareness to cancer in young people in a nationwide scope.
Yeah, and it's cancer in young adults is pretty, well, I said 70,000 people every year in that 15 to 39 age range. That's a lot of people.
It is a lot of people. And as you said, you know, the adolescent young adult population that we generally define as at age 15 to 39 at the age of diagnosis, about 70,000 people in the United States are diagnosed with cancer every year in that age group. And pediatric cancers are certainly something that are well publicized, and we do a lot of work in treating younger kids. But, you know, the number of adolescent young adults is about seven times the number of pediatric cancers. And so, you know, between those two age groups, there's a big burden both from a patient-by-patient standpoint, but also a public health piece. I'd like to say this, too, a little bit about cancers. You know, the overall outcomes in patients with cancer who are treated for cancer has improved dramatically in younger children and in older adults over the past 20 years. But we're still trying to catch up in this adolescent young adult population, age 15 to 39, so we can achieve some of those good outcomes.
Yeah. How is cancer of this age group different than other age groups?
So the you know, the most common cancers in adults in the United States right now are prostate and breast cancer in men and women, respectively, lung cancer and colorectal cancer. So those are the top three in adults. In the adolescent young adult population, in women, breast cancer is the most common, followed by thyroid, and then there's quite a bit of burden as far as melanoma, lymphoma, leukemia. And in men, young men, testicular cancer is actually the most common, followed by melanoma and lymphoma. So the types of cancers are different. We think that the biology of the cancers behave differently in this adolescent young adult population, and it really forces us to think about how cancers develop and how to treat them most effectively.
Yeah, it's fertility issues. I'm sure would be a consideration in this age group. Dealing with that has to be a challenge.
It certainly does. And so we'll meet patients who are either thinking about having a family someday or who already have young children. And talking about fertility is an important piece. I think when someone first hears the words, you have cancer or you have melanoma or you have leukemia, you know, the attention's pretty immediate on the treatment of that disease. But within the first couple of days of putting together a treatment plan, we really need to think about how do we preserve fertility in this young man or this young woman who may want to start a family someday. And so we certainly look at treatment of adolescent young adults in a multidisciplinary fashion, but part of that importance is getting fertility specialists involved early on.
Yeah, I think in Suleika's situation, she writes about this in one of her columns, harvesting eggs, harvesting her eggs to because she knew she was not going to be able to have children after the chemotherapy.
Right. And so I think it's important to know that, you know, some forms of chemotherapy, while not safe to give to a woman who's pregnant, does not necessarily impact fertility in the long term. And so when we're talking with a patient about the type of cancer they have and the type of treatment they have, they may be able to have children without doing, you know, egg preservation or in men sperm banking. But it's something that we do need to talk about early on in their course of treatment.
Yeah. When cancer is found in someone young, so I keep referring back to her, but she writes about this, her wondering, is it ever going to come back? Are there chances of recurrence different in when cancer is found in someone young?
It's a hard question to answer in general terms. Like older adults and young children with cancer, adolescent young adults with cancer, they come in all different types. The cancers are different. Yeah. They behave differently. So the chance of coming back, or what we call recurrence, varies on the type of cancer, varies based on the type of treatment they've had. But certainly when we're talking about post-cancer follow-up surveillance and survivorship, you know, the question about is this cancer going to come back is certainly weighing on the patient's mind, on the family member's mind, and certainly on those who take care of them too, because it can be devastating when someone does so well for so long to have the cancer come back. And that affects the treating team as well.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's take some calls. You can join in, by the way, 800-642-1234. Give a call. And we'll turn to Kim in East Troy. Kim, thank you for calling.
Yes, I just wanted to share our story. Our son was diagnosed with cancer just before his second birthday. And, of course, at that time, your thought is to, of course, do whatever you can to continue to have your child so that your child does not succumb to the cancer. And we did. But, of course, we also were worried about his fertility. And then as years have gone on, he was on chemo for many, many years. And as he got older and started to think of a family, of course, that was a concern. And so I'm happy to report that he just had his first baby girl, and she is healthy. And I just thank God that, you know, his treatment was not affecting or did not affect his fertility. So we are very thrilled with that. And then unfortunately, then I was also diagnosed with multiple myeloma, which is a blood cancer. So, and I am in remission after two stem cell transplants. So we have successes in our family. It's sad we did have two bad stories, but we do have two great outcomes also.
Oh, Kim, thank you so much for calling. A comment from you, Dr. Madison?
I think it just echoes that there are several successes in oncology and hematology, and whether that's pediatric cancers or cancers in older adults, we have to think not just about getting a patient into remission and long-term cure, but also being more and more thoughtful about what types of side effects that someone may experience down the road. And so that really is informing some of our treatment decisions and some of our research that we're doing moving forward. So thank you, Kim, for sharing your story.
Thanks, Kim. Appreciate your comments as well. Thank you very much. Well, as a physician, what challenges do you face when treating young adults?
That's an excellent question. As a physician, it's not just me and the nursing staff. We have a big team of people who are all equally important in taking care of these patients. And so I think maybe to answer part of your question, just the unique challenges that the adolescent young adult population has coming into a cancer diagnosis is oftentimes these people are living healthy, full lives, and cancer really puts a stop to that. Not only do they have to think about mortality, maybe for the first time as an adolescent young adult, but also the potential loss of fertility, how the cancer diagnosis may affect relationships, how it may affect their school or career opportunities. And so it's known that patients who are adolescent young adults with cancer have higher rates of depression and anxiety compared with sibling controls. And so it's not just the medical team and the medical decisions, but it's really getting involved social workers, as I mentioned, the importance of fertility specialists, working with health psychologists, in addition to the oncologists, the surgeons, the radiation oncologists who are all taking care of the patient. So really bringing this big team together to be available to the patient, to identify needs that they have that are unique because of their relatively young age.
From a personal standpoint, as a physician, as someone who has to deal with these kinds of issues that are serious and sad, oftentimes issues, it has to take a toll on physicians as well.
You know, I think that's a good point. I think, you know, the impact on the medical team, on the nursing staff is big, especially as you look at it over the years. But I'll say this, I think sometimes the most inspiring acts are done by the patients themselves. I remember a few patients who I had would, you know, they'd bring in clever T-shirts with their visits, or they'd find a way to make the treating team and help them laugh through it too. And so I think that patients bring a lot of resilience, their families bring a lot of resilience and humor, and that helps not only themselves get through their treatments, but also, you know, brings joy to the clinic staff as well.
Yeah, that has to be the case. Well, as a researcher, I don't know how much research that you do, but is there a lot of research in cancer in this age group?
There needs to be more. I am a researcher. I do primarily clinical research, so we will have opened clinical trials for patients. And because of the relatively rare diseases that we treat, we are part of not only institutional studies that are run through UW, but also part of the National Cancer Institute cooperative groups, and many of the studies I'm involved with are through that group. But I think one thing we've realized is that, as I mentioned at the beginning, that overall outcomes for younger children and older adults have improved over the past 20 years, but not necessarily in this adolescent young adult population. And part of that is the clinical trial enrollment is lower than in either young children or older adults. There's statistics that show that about 10% of the patients 15 to 19 with cancer are enrolled in trials. And in the 20 to 39 year age group, it's only 1 to 2%. And so there's a big gap between the number of people who enroll in clinical trials. And not all clinical trials are necessarily, you know, early phase therapy that's never been tried before. A lot of it's variations on standards of care we've had. But
yeah, and I'll tell you what, we'll continue with that conversation. Dr. Ryan Madison, we'll take a quick look at the news and then we'll be back. So everybody, you stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about cancer today, cancer, zeroing in on cancer in young adults, but taking other questions as well relating to it with our guest, Dr. Ryan Madison, Associate Professor of Medicine within the Division of Hematology Oncology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He practices at the UW Carbone Cancer Center, where he specializes in blood cancers, including leukemia. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Dr. Madison, before we go back to the phones, I want to continue on with our discussion about research. And you were mentioning that enrollments in trials is very low in that 15 to 39-year age cohort.
Right, and that's one thought, is that outcomes could improve if we can enroll more young people on clinical trials. You know, the pediatricians do a nice job of getting, you know, a large percentage of their young patients on studies. And as I mentioned, the statistic about 1 to 2% of people aged 20 to 39 are enrolled in clinical trials. And clinical trials are really a way of moving forward our standards of care. And so we are, we and all other NCI-designated cancer centers, that's certainly a priority to try to open studies and accrue to those studies.
And I did want to mention that there, again, that there is a fall conference, the UW Carbone Cancer Center. And it's Friday, October 19th at the Monona Terrace in Madison, focusing on young adults and cancer, correct?
That is. And so this is an annual conference. I believe this is the 17th annual Fall Cancer Conference sponsored by the Carbone Cancer Center. My colleague Noelle LeConte is a gastrointestinal oncologist, and she's the conference director. And it's got a great lineup of speakers. It's from 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. on Friday, October 19th. As you mentioned, your previous guest, Zuleika Jawad, is the keynote speaker, so I'm looking forward to having her share her stories. And there's going to be internal and external experts on cancer survivorship, health psychology, nursing, fertility preservation, child life specialists, and genetics. And so a lot of these multidisciplinary aspects I talk about that are so important are going to be well represented at this conference.
Yeah.
And it's designed not just for healthcare professionals, but also for patients, for family members, for advocates. So look forward to seeing a lot of people there.
Yeah. And folks can register online. It's $40, but that includes breakfast and lunch. So pretty good deal there. Go to uwhealth.org. Slash cancer conference, uwhealth.org/cancer conference. We'll try to bring that up again near the end of the show as well. You can join in too again, 1-800-642-1234. Don in Eau Claire has a question for us. Don, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my calls. I'm a 95-year-old male. Retired physician. Cognitively, I'm still in good shape, fortunately, although physically I have my problems. My question is, I have the feeling the longer I live, the more things can happen to me. I was born and raised in Kansas with a fair skin, strawberry blonde hair. I didn't think I had a melanophore in my body. I had a squamous cell carcinoma in my scalp. I've had several basal cell carcinomas. I had another lesion on the back of my neck, which my dermatologist thought was surely another basal cell. He took a biopsy. It turned out to be an amelanotic melanoma. So here I am at 95. I've had all three kinds of skin cancer. My concern now is that many years ago, when diuretics were popular as an initial treatment and still are, I guess, for treatment of hypertension, I took a drug, which was a combination drug, and I developed what I was sure was gynecomastia on the right side. My physician agreed with me. He did, though, in the end, do an excision biopsy. It was gynecomastia. Well, lo and behold, here about a month ago, or maybe a little less, I had been given a drug for reducing prostate size. I had never had any symptoms of prostatism, but I was hospitalized. My bladder filled up. They wanted to catheterize me because the ultrasound that said showed I had 700 cc's of urine on my bladder. I begged them not to catheterize me. They finally acceded to me and did not. I avoided, and all was well. But the drug for prostatism, my regular doctor said, you can discontinue it if you want or keep taking it. I cut down to half a dose, and then finally about a month ago or 2 weeks ago, I decided to discontinue it altogether.
A comment from you, Dr. Madison?
Yeah, Don, I just want to thank you for, I'm sure you've taken care of thousands of people over your career as a retired physician, so thank you for calling in. What I'd like to do is key in on the point he made about being diagnosed with a melanoma, if I could.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, he identifies a risk factor of sun exposure as a young child, and I think that's so important to recognize, and I'm going to tie this back into the adolescent young adult population. You know, there are certainly some cancers for which we know risk factors, even in young people like melanoma, where it's important to get regular screening at an age-appropriate time. One of the challenges, though, I think one of the reasons that so many young people show up with advanced cancers is because when their physician sees them for a complaint such as a cough or a headache or something that most likely is nothing serious, when those symptoms persist and despite a round of antibiotics, the cough doesn't go away, that's when we start looking. So I think just being aware in the physician community, the clinician community, that cancer does happen in young people will allow us to think, you know, maybe look sooner for that less common but serious illness that may be causing symptoms.
Don, thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or comments. You mentioned that among young women in that cohort, breast cancer was the most common form of cancer, if I'm not mistaken.
It is in that that broad age range of 15 to 39. It's the most common. Breast cancer is going to be more common in women who are, you know, 25 to 39. Younger than 25, it's going to be more thyroid or melanoma or lymphoma. But certainly, breast cancer is the most common cancer in that age group, broadly speaking. That raises the question about breast cancer screening, which is probably beyond the scope of today's conversation. But I think the main thing for adolescents and young adults is if there's a symptom that they are concerned about or that's new, they should, you know, see a clinician to investigate that further.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And the young males, you mentioned testicular cancer.
Right.
And, you know, I can't remember even ever having somebody explain to me how to do a self-analysis for something
right.
like that.
Yeah, I think so. You know, any young man who has a lump that's not there or that's new or that's changing, you know, should share that with their healthcare professional. And that's just generally good advice, I think, to eliminate problems early on if something can be either diagnosed as something less serious than cancer or start treatment for a cancer if it's diagnosed early.
Yeah. Should young adult, you know, if you're a young adult and have cancer, should you be looking for physicians or hospitals that specialize in this age group?
I think there's good evidence. So the short answer is yes. There's good evidence in the literature that shows that adolescents and young adults treated at specialized centers do better than those who are treated at centers that see fewer of these patients. At the beginning of the show, I mentioned a number of cancers, and so there's not necessarily an adolescent young adult clinic that specializes in all things, but a lot of the aspects of care that I talked about, the multidisciplinary involvement with lots of different professionals, can be brought to either the breast clinic in women with breast cancer or the genitourinary clinic in young men with testicular cancer. But generally, treating at centers that see a lot of patient volume is beneficial if that's possible.
What are the outcomes for in that cohort for women with breast cancer?
It's hard to generalize. A lot of the risk factors as far as hormonal status, extent and stage of the cancer still drives outcomes more so than the age of the patient. But in general, younger patients can tolerate more intensive chemotherapy and radiation if that's part of the treatment. But it's hard to kind of paint it with a broad brush as far as outcomes.
And is that the typical treatment for a young woman with breast cancer?
So usually surgical resection, and then if radiation or chemotherapy are indicated, that would be a decision that the patient with their healthcare team would make.
Yeah, makes sense. Doctor, our guest today talking about cancer in young adults, and we're taking other cancer questions from not only about young adults, but others as well with our guest, Dr. Ryan Madison, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Wisconsin. Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you and we'll get you on pretty quickly. What are some of the emotional effects for patients who are young adults? You talked a little about that, but I'd okay, hear.
Yeah. So I think, you know, like a patient of any age who's facing a serious diagnosis, you know, there's first kind of shock and then denial and then gradually acceptance and then resolution to get through it. And, you know, people come as they are. Some people are going to be more prone to, you know, whether they have a history of depression or anxiety. But what we know from the literature that survivors of cancer, meaning those who have been diagnosed anytime through treatment or long-term follow-up, do have higher rates of depression and anxiety compared with sibling controls in some studies. And so we do have a great group of health psychologists who work closely with our cancer patients that we want to make sure their resources are available. And working with a patient's primary care provider and or psychologist or psychiatrist, if they have a history of mental illness, is a key part in making sure that they do well through their treatment.
It must. I would think anybody going through this has got to be, for the most part, a depressing kind of thing for everybody, not only the patient but the family as well.
Yeah. Well, I can say this, and I'm not going to cite a specific conversation with the patient, obviously, but I think, in one clinic visit, you might talk about, fear of dying, and then, boy, this chemotherapy schedule is really kind of messing with my class schedule or, my family gathering that we have planned. And so you're really covering some very serious topics, but also with some more what might be viewed as lighthearted or kind of annoyances in the same conversation. But again, I'll go back to the piece I said at the beginning, anecdotes from my practice. I'm really impressed, every day by the resilience of the patients and the family members I see going through what they go through, and they still carry on and they try to put together a life as normal as possible. And I think your previous guest touched upon that, in her conversation very well.
Are there plenty of support groups available for this group?
There are. So again, going back to the cancer conference that's going to be in October, that's, I think, a nice resource for the community. So it's October 19th. Groups that are active on in the Madison area are Gilda's Club. They have a lot of good resources. There's a group on campus called the University of Wisconsin Center for Patient Partnerships, and they can connect patients with different resources that are helpful. And I don't know if there's a physical presence in Wisconsin, but there's an online group called Stupid Cancer, which I think is a great name, that was founded in 2007. So I imagine if one would search for Stupid Cancer on their favorite web browser, you'll get the right site. But they have nice connections, both connecting patients with each other as well as with social work resources, legal resources, advocacy resources, trying to do all we can to get this patient population insured, which is a difficult problem sometimes. These are young people who may be either between jobs or just coming off their parents' insurance, but connecting them with those resources that are so important.
That's got to be awful when you're that age, because you are pretty much off your parents' health care, may not have a job of your own, or maybe just getting into a job.
Right, or may have a job that doesn't provide insurance, too. So, part of the early connections that we build in our clinic are with our social workers to make sure that patients are insured, and so this is not going to financially bankrupt them through their treatment.
Vic emailed to ask where you would recommend donation be sent for young adult cancer research. He says very little cancer donations monies go to adolescents, babies, and children. Is that true?
Well, there's a lot of good resources, and I think some of the ones that I mentioned, would be great. So Gilda's Club, Stupid Cancer, the NCI Designated Cancer Center, near you, is always going to have programs that they're going to put donations toward that will be helpful for this population.
Do you work very closely with the American Family Children's Hospital?
I do. In fact, my offices are right down the hall from the pediatricians, and because I see mostly patients with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which is very common in children, all often share treatment ideas, protocols, and management advice with them, and they with me. So I do work very closely with that group.
It's a blessing to have that capability, as for sure. Your research, I'd like to talk a little about your research, too, because you specialize in blood cancers, including leukemia. What type of research are you doing, or what's going on in this area?
Right. So being part of the NCI Designated Cancer Center, we maintain a relationship with the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, which is one of the three cooperative groups sponsored by the NCI. So there's treatment protocols through them that we enroll patients to. A lot of our faculty are leaders on some of these trials. I'm a co-leader on an ALL study for actually a little older patients, 35 to 70. But much of our work is done in the context of cooperative group studies. There's a lot of great work being done by both the adults and pediatrician colleagues that I work with in immunotherapy for blood cancers. Chimeric antigen receptor T cells, or CAR T cells, is a form of immunotherapy that's coming online, for which we've had studies open in that area now for a couple of years. And so there's a lot of work being done here at the Carbone Cancer Center, and it's work being shared by amongst other cancer centers around the country.
I had the opportunity, I guess, to help a friend who had pancreatic cancer and unfortunately passed away. But through the various treatments, he was part of, I think, a couple of different research programs that were going on, and, you know, he had agreed to do it, but he was happy to agree to be, you know, a part of it. And I assume this is something that's fairly common.
It is, and we try to enroll patients on appropriate studies when they're available. And, you know, most research is done to try to use either existing drugs in new combinations or newer drugs that we haven't tried in a lot of patients to see. And not all research is done in the context of, you know, a patient's been through already three or four treatments. We are sometimes using newer therapies up front to try to improve how patients can do both living longer and living with a better quality of life. So clinical trials are something that are important for patients to consider and families to consider when they're being treated, regardless of the cancer type and regardless of the stage of the cancer.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to, just because I think it's important, this fall conference, UW Carbone Cancer Center annual fall conference. And anybody's invited to that, right?
Right. It's open to the public, and come one, come all. It's Friday from 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. on October 19th on Monona Terrace. And as you mentioned, I think you gave the web link, but you can register online through the UW Health Carbone Cancer Center website.
And it's $40 a person. That includes breakfast and lunch. And some of the topics, I know cancer and sexuality, that's got to be an important area, you know, in the line of work you're doing and with that age cohort that you're working with.
Right. We want to make sure that patients have the resources they need so they can maintain their quality of life during and after treatment.
Yeah, and so it's not only that, but fertility preservation, genetic testing, helping young survivors and parents get through a cancer diagnosis. So, and then, of course, the speaker, Saleka Jawad, is...
Right. She'll be the keynote speaker. She'll be leading off the morning. And, you know, one of the more interesting speakers, too, for this conference is there's a child life specialist going to be speaking about, you know, young patients who have young children, so how the treatment of cancer on a parent would affect a young child. So that's another piece that I think will be unique.
Well, I'm really happy that you were able to take the time to be with us today, Dr. Madison. I want to thank you so much for being with us, and I hope we'll have a chance to talk again. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. I appreciate the time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Dr. Ryan Madison is an associate professor of medicine within the Division of Hematology Oncology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, practices at the UW Carbone Cancer Center, and specializes in blood cancers, including leukemia. Great to have him along. And that, the again, registering online for that conference, just go to uwhealth.org, Cancer Conference. And we'll look forward to that conference, and certainly all of the speakers that will be present. Tomorrow we'll talk with David Drake and Jamie Knack. They'll be back to talk about Wisconsin wildlife, so I hope you can join us for that. And in the meantime, Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.